Times Magazine, Lisa Goldman.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Jesse.
It's been nearly 1,300 days of war following that Russian invasion of February of 2022.
Canada will always stand in solidarity with Ukraine.
CBC News has confirmed that Transport Minister Chrystia Freeland is leaving the Liberal cabinet to take on the role of international envoy for Ukraine.
Some of her comments comes as Prime Minister Mark Carney has promised deeper Canadian involvement in trying to stop the war.
Mark Carney said that if there is a ceasefire in Ukraine, Canada would step up as part of the so-called coalition of the willing.
And I would not exclude the presence of troops.
Lisa, I thought maybe we should check back in on Ukraine. It's interesting what the media pays a lot of attention to and what it forgets about, but that's still happening. The level of attention is not necessarily in line with the human cost, which is great. I think there's over 100,000 deaths in the Ukraine-Russia war. I will admit that what got my attention back on Ukraine and Canada's relationship to it, this piece written by Chrystia Freeland. Did you read this thing?
I did, in the Financial Times. Very interesting opinion piece.
Yeah, I'll confess that when Chrystia Freeland left cabinet to become Canada's envoy to Ukraine, I was a little bit like, okay, her political career is obviously over. She saved the party from destruction, but she'll never be prime minister. What's the point of being in the mix and try to work your way back up to deputy PM and maybe run a leadership campaign again? It's not going to happen. So this is her prize. This is her passion issue. And so maybe this was a gift to her. And maybe it's more important to her to be like, I am the Ukraine czar for Canada than it is to actually like playing a real role in what's going on over there. But maybe I didn't give her enough credit. Like, something is very interesting and different about the way she was talking about Ukraine. I'm going to read a bit about it, then I want to hear what you have to say about it. We need Ukraine as much as it needs us. It is time to change how we think about Ukraine, writes Freeland. Forget about saving Ukraine. The fact is that we need Ukraine to save us. President Zelensky has always been right. This is a conflict between light and darkness. Trump got it right. At the UN, Ukraine is a winner and Ukraine can win. Ukraine is Europe's innovation nation, building, deploying, and reinventing drones and missiles with a bottom-up, decentralized approach to war and innovation that looks a lot more like Silicon Valley than the Pentagon. A strong, prosperous Ukraine will be Europe's shield, Europe's arsenal, and Europe's innovator. Lisa, this is very different than the, like, we all must save Ukraine kind of rhetoric that we got in the past. This is like, we need them more than they need us, and they're leading the way. What is she talking about?
I think it's interesting, first of all, to see the platform that she chose, right? Which is a very prestigious, very important international paper. Their subscription costs a fortune, an absolute fortune. So if you're not in finance or have a free sub somehow, you're probably not going to be reading that piece. So the question is, who are the readers that she's targeting? Those are influential people on a global scale, internationally influential people. And I think that speaks a lot to the tone of the article and probably to the point she's trying to make here, which is that this is something that affects all of us. This issue of Ukraine's rise, whether Ukraine survives or not, is something that affects all of us. If Russia were to succeed, for example, in ending the war in its favor, in Russia's favor, what would that say about the domino effect of authoritarianism? And also, you know, about the ability of democracies to stand up to authoritarianism? It's a pretty important issue right now, given what's happening in the world.
So perhaps she's speaking to policymakers, but also to finance.
Absolutely.
This is part of what Canada is up to in trying to create this new trade alliance and trying to reach out to whatever Western countries and European countries still consider themselves part of rules-based order, which is not merely a political pack, but is like a trade pack, and saying, we can't let Russia win here because this is basically the beachhead. This is the tip of the spear for Europe and Europeanness and the European market.
And the European market, and I think that's the main point there. And I'll just warm to this point that you're so elegantly expanding upon, which is You know, there is a sort of a feeling, I think, amongst business people that the oligarchs, they function quite well with an authoritarianism, right? And a lot of business people, for example, in Israel, which is the story that I tend to follow the most, a lot of these pro-democracy activists are going to the business people who are theoretically liberals and saying, why don't you guys throw your weight behind these pro-democracy protests? And they say, listen, we don't get involved in politics. What we care about is if the market is doing well, if the market conditions allow us to build our businesses. And I think for a lot of people, if they're just going to be cynical and take the humanitarian aspect out of the story, whether or not Ukraine survives is not that important. It doesn't affect the markets. And I think Chrystia Freeland is taking a very pragmatic perspective here and saying to the leaders of the world and to the business people who are so influential on international politics that democracy actually is good for business. That's a really good argument right now because authoritarianism is succeeding on the back of the fact that business people are saying is good for them.
I'm rarely accused of elegance, I'll take it. But I think you're right, because she's pointing to a couple of different things. One is sort of a story about Ukraine that I think is grounded in reality and is extraordinary, that this a really young nation that has deep ties to Russia and yet westernized rapidly and just embraced.
And overthrew authoritarianism.
Yeah, but the story that we've been telling ourselves for the better part of the last 100 years, this is what you want to be a part of. You want to be a part of this global economy. So I was thinking of it in that context of the economic boost that Ukraine experienced in the early 2000s, the globalization of Ukraine into global markets. But Freeland is also talking about their warfare innovations and the economy of warfare. And I, you know, it brought my attention to this New York Times piece about drone warfare. And it's really fascinating, scary, weird stuff.
Very interesting.
The conflict, writes the Times, bears little resemblance now to the early battles with Russian columns and small bands of Ukrainian infantry. No, what we see now is a rapid advancement of drone warfare. Speeding cars or trucks no longer provide protection from faster flying drones. Soldiers hike for miles, ducking into cover through drone-infested territory, too dangerous for jeeps, armored personnel carriers, or tanks. Soldiers say that it has become strangely personal because buzzing robots hunt specific cars or even individual soldiers. Like Black Mirror, where there's like a drone. And there's a lot of praise for the way in which Ukraine, not just the drones themselves, but the way the drones get their orders. They've decentralized. It's not like this top-down hierarchical command. I think they're using AI. Decisions can get made within each battalion. But I'm reading this article in The Guardian, Killing Machines, about just how advanced drone warfare is now in this war. And it's a little bit hazy as to exactly what level of decision the AI is making. But it suggests very strongly that increasingly decisions are being made by the robots, and there's a real push for there to be some international standards and for us to enter into some kind of Geneva Convention style. Can we allow robots to decide who to kill? Is that okay? It's bringing that stuff up. So, you know, there's kind of dual narratives if you read the stories about this. One celebrating Ukraine and Russia, who's also fighting back with drones. There's drone versus drone is happening, but it seems like it's the Wild West, and lots of people who are involved in military technology are flocking to Ukraine because this is like a live testing ground where you can try stuff out. They're doing a lot of this with like off-the-shelf hobby drones.
Yeah, very cheap.
The sheer scale of their production from guys in their garages who are actually streamlining, 3D printing, and turning out quantities of these UAVs you wouldn't have thought was imaginable.
The Ukrainians, of course, have taken that to an extreme level, right, where we're seeing crowdsourced efforts from the civilian population building drones or parts of drones and sending them to the front line.
They've got all kinds of stuff. They've got, like, mother drones that protect a fleet of smaller drones. They've got drones that can carry a bunch of little drones long distances and then let the fast little drones out to go and actually kill people. They're ahead of the Hollywood and Black Mirror dramatizations of this technology. What's actually happening is ahead of the dramatization.
When I read that New York Times story, I thought it was fascinating. I think I read it twice. First of all, I remember at the beginning of the war, some of the senior officers in the Ukrainian army were incredibly worried about Elon Musk's control of Starlink because Musk was taking a pro-Putin position and he was basically saying, we'll shut you down. And without access to these satellites, the Ukrainian army felt like their hands were tied. And so it seems that during this war, they've come up with some incredibly clever low-tech methods of circumventing these oligarchs that are controlling the expensive technology like Starlink in the case of Elon Musk. I think another really interesting innovation they came up with that was quite widely publicized were these sort of stilts that they were walking on through minefields to avoid having their legs blown off. And So they are demonstrating a sort of an inexpensive, very intelligent, innovative warfare, which seems to me something very interesting and worth following.
And the Canadian aspect of this is, again, shifting the appeal to, like, refocus on Ukraine from a humanitarian, let's care more about Ukraine, to a self-interested argument. The Globe and Mail writing, Ukraine showed that drones are the new bullets. Why doesn't Canada get this? Kind of like, how are we letting ourselves fall behind on drones? There's opportunity here, I read in the Globe and Mail. The technology exists. Canada's tech ecosystem can deliver if the government provides clear demand and stable funding. We once led the world in radar communications and aerospace. Let's not miss the opportunity. And then Wesley Wark, who's been on this show before, writing in The Walrus, how Canada squandered its drone lead. This isn't about Ukraine. It's about us.
A new global arms race for drones has Canada's military playing catch-up.
Ground zero of that race is Ukraine, where drones, large and small, are now the deadliest weapon on the battlefield. Canada's biggest drone purchase to date is the large fixed-wing Sky Guardian, which won't be delivered till 2033.
Why are we falling behind in our contribution to warfare innovation? Is this a tactic to get money?
For Canada?
Is this a tactic for Freeland to kind of build the consensus?
That's an interesting question. I would say that as a journalist who's used to reading between the lines, I don't know, but I think that Canadians have been having this conversation in the media for many years about falling behind, right? We outsourced our foreign policy to the U.S. We don't have any significant fighter planes. We have one ship, I'm exaggerating, of course, in our Navy. But there has been this sort of breastfeeding and lamenting for many years in Canada about us falling behind.
Canada's Minister of National Defense issued a stark warning about the state of military recruitment.
If what you have been doing for decades is no longer working for you, you can't just keep doing it.
This is borderline atrocious.
Experts say it's a crisis brought about by successive Liberal and Conservative governments kicking tough decisions about equipment down the road.
If we just got really, I'll just use the word lazy, of doing it a certain way all the time, and we just can't afford to do that anymore.
I don't know if Freeland is trying to convince Canadians that they need to beef up their military in the way that Ukraine is by using inexpensive but intelligent technology. But I would think that if that were her argument, she would probably choose a Canadian media outlet for her opinion piece rather than the Financial Times.
I think that's very clever, reading between the lines. Like, you don't appeal to the Canadian public by going to the Financial Times. You're trying to build a consensus with other people. Lisa, did you read into Freeland's article anything from a direct Canadian self-interest, a maybe passive-aggressive corollary being drawn, like Ukraine is to Russia as Canada might be to America? And let's change the way we talk about Ukraine, because that actually is about us.
Maybe, but that's not the way I read it. It's interesting that you bring it up. I wouldn't dismiss the point, but what I saw was that she did throw a bone to Trump in that piece when she said that he was correct about one thing, I think.
They're winners and they can win, yeah.
They're winners, yes.
That's what Trump's saying these days. It's not what he said before.
Tonight, President Trump urging Ukraine to expand the battlefield after earlier warning they may have to concede territory for peace. Writing, I think Ukraine, with the support of the European Union, is in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form.
God knows what he'll say next week.
Months ago, he said that Russia's earned some of Ukraine and they should just give it to them. So who knows what's...
Yeah, if Trump is feeling irked by Putin, then the Ukrainians are winners. And if Putin throws something toward Trump, then he'll turn around and crap on the Ukrainians again, obviously. I think about this 51st state thing. I personally just feel like everyone should not talk about it because you don't want to poke the bear when it comes to Trump. So no, that's not what I saw in the article.
After the break, we'll try to figure out if Canada is recommitting to help Ukraine for real. And if that's the case, then how come we're treating the Ukrainian refugees in Canada the way that we are? I actually can't figure out whether we're increasing our involvement and attachment to Ukraine or decreasing.
And I commit that Canada will remain by Ukraine's side in your fight for independence. Canada pledged an additional $2 billion in military assistance. And today I'm proud to announce that over $1 billion of that support will be used to strengthen your arsenal with urgently needed drones, ammunition, armored vehicles, material that will arrive next month.
Like, on the one hand, I do hear Carney is saying, hey, we're not even ruling out putting troops in Ukraine.
On Sunday, Mark Carney said Canada could play a peacekeeping role if there's a ceasefire.
I would not exclude the presence of troops.
which seems to suggest to me like that he's focusing on this. And on the other hand, I'm reading that like that early moment where we were just opening the floodgates and frankly letting Ukrainians jump the queue and come to Canada.
Providing a safe haven for Ukrainian refugees.
In this dark hour, we are with you.
Canada opens the door for emergency residents for those fleeing the war.
And now we're reading like on the other end of that, like these people are like a few hundred thousand Ukrainians in Canada. Many came here on a 3-year temporary visa, and a lot of those expired this year. So now a bunch of them, they're stuck in limbo without permanent resident status, waiting for a work visa. If their kids go to university here, they're paying international student rates. In Ontario, their kids don't even get OHIP medical coverage. They have to pay higher taxes if they want to buy a house. And they're hitting all the same issues that a lot of other people who came to Canada thinking that we were under one immigration regime and then Canada changes its mind and then you're stuck in the middle. All of that stuff, there's no special rules for Ukrainians, it seems. And then little whispers of something concerning happening. And this is not like something that I want to put out there as a reported fact, but we always make a judgment call. Like when we have reason to believe that something's happening or might be happening, do we want to let you know? So take it with a grain of salt, but there is chatter online about Ukrainian men receiving immigration requests from the Canadian government that ask them to document their military service or exemption in Ukraine. And so Ukrainian men are wondering, is Canada trying to crack down on draft dodgers? This is coming from Ukrainian Canada Public Group. And we read about it on a site that I won't even claim to know. I'm not going to say anything negative about it. It's called visitukraine.today. So I don't know if there's a tourism site or what. But men are reporting, according to the site, that they are getting letters from IRCC, Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada, requesting official documents confirming has Ukraine exempted you from military service. And the type of letter is called a procedural fairness letter. And this is the kind of letter that IRCC sends when they're fact-checking an application, like they're not sure if they believe what somebody's put on an application. So Canada does not want Ukrainian men who are avoiding military service. They want men who have been exempted from military service, and it seems like they're checking now. So that's one. And then the other thing that I found interesting in looking at, like, where is Canada now on this is way back, Trudeau had this cockamamie plan when he was facing all kinds of criticism for the gun buyback scheme, that Canada was going to, we're outlawing certain assault-style guns, and then the gun retailers were saying, well, what about my stock? What about all these unsold guns? And Trudeau said, here's what we're going to do. We'll buy them back from you, the Canadian government, and we'll give them to Ukraine.
Send them to Ukraine.
Here's Minister Dominic LeBlanc announcing that plan.
Part of that process, the government of Canada has committed to the Ukrainian government to identify whether some of these guns could be donated to support the fight for democracy in Ukraine.
And then there was another program that David Pugliese wrote about in the Ottawa Citizen that we have thousands of handguns from World War II.
Oh, for God's sake.
From World War II that we can no longer find parts for. So we're going to give that was what Canada was going to do. I'm not sure what happened with the World War II handguns that were slated for destruction, but Carney has said that the gun buyback plan with Ukraine for the assault-style rifle gun buyback plan has been discontinued due to, quote, extremely limited interest. No that the country that is innovating drone warfare on the cutting edge.
So insulting, isn't it? Like giving your old clothes with holes in them to poor people.
Here's Grandpa's six-shooter. You go kill a Russian. What all of this leads me to is, like, do you have a sense as to whether or not, as Trump seems to be changing, like flip-flopping daily as to whether or not he's just leaving Ukraine to the wolves or he's now saying that they're winners and they can win. Where are we on this? Is this a dream of Freeland's or is this what Canada is moving towards?
Where are we in terms of Canadian involvement in Ukraine?
Are we increasing our involvement in this?
So I don't think so. Again, without any insider information, just reading the papers through the eyes of a journalist and maybe talking to a few people who are in the know, right? Russia experts, Ukraine experts. What I really see is Carney, when he came into office, made that now famous speech where he said the era of Canada's, I forget the exact term he used, but its relationship with the U.S. was over. Its prior uncritical open border relationship with the U.S. was over.
The old relationship we had with the United States, based on deepening integration of our economies and tight security and military cooperations, is over.
And it seems to me that since then he has been taking pretty active steps to pivot toward Western Europe and Central Europe and to create an alliance with the major economic and democratic powers like France and the UK. And so all of those countries are now aligning, I think, back officing about aligning on their policy regarding Ukraine and also about Israel-Gaza. And I just think it's just creating new alliances. I don't think that it's anything more than that. Do you?
Well, I mean, in line with that, so that alliance goes, Ukraine may go. Ukraine is increasing in importance to that pack, to that alliance.
Yeah, I actually think that's really interesting.
We would be along for that ride, right?
Yeah, I think so. Like being on the right side of history sort of thing, being with the rational actors. And also, both France and the UK have really big problems with the surging authoritarian populist right. And so I think everyone, because of their domestic issues as well, feels the need to form a solid unit between democracies right now. For various reasons.
That sounds correct, but the prevailing wisdom and sort of rationalist, pragmatist conclusions that I've been reading for the last year at least is that, like, we know that Ukraine's the victim, we know that Ukraine is right, but come on already, you're going to have to give up some land to make this thing end.
I don't think anyone can see the end game here right now. The Ukrainians have been very clear that they're not about to make any territorial concessions. And I don't blame them. That seems kind of Chamberlain-esque. I think Poland, for all of its right-wing government, they've been very clear that they were right. They told us so, that Russia had strong territorial ambitions and that they must be stopped. So I think that no one knows how this war is going to end. I think the uncertainty is combined with the incompetence of the policymakers and their dithering is a very toxic combination. But it does seem to me that smart people like Krohn, and Carney's a very smart guy, are looking at the European and global picture and saying we need to stand up together. And I think that's the right decision.
Lisa, we're going to duly note a couple of stories that we want to make sure people do not miss. What do you have?
I want to duly note that the European Commission published a report about the efforts of various countries within the EU to promote media literacy. I don't think it received an enormous amount of legacy media coverage, and that Lithuania has probably the most comprehensive implemented plan to make sure that its citizens are able to discern the difference between fact and falsehood, which they've been doing for a while through the Ministry of Education. Media literacy is taught in schools. Kids are taught to discern between truth and lie and to know how to verify whether or not something is true, which is something that's a legacy from their days as part of the USSR. And this came to mind recently when I was having a conversation with a friend of mine whom I hadn't seen for many years, highly educated, polyglot, well-traveled, but she works in business, not in media. And at one point she turned to me in the conversation and she said to me very artlessly, "I was reading this article in X publication and I just didn't know whether or not it was true. How do you determine whether or not a report in the media is accurate?" And I thought, how fascinating, because I actually taught a course in media literacy at a small college in Quebec one semester, and I was really amazed to hear that it seemed like quite a significant proportion of the students in the class that I taught did not believe that there was such a thing as objective truth. And I printed out several articles that were, I just copied them onto plain paper without any identifying bylines or mastheads and passed them out. Some of them were not legitimate stories and others were well-founded reported stories. And I asked them if they could tell the difference. And if they had doubts, how would they go about verifying the information in the articles? These were 20-year-old university students from, you know, pretty good college. They did not know the difference, and they did not know how they would go about telling the difference. I was shocked, appalled, frightened, and I have decided that when I become a billionaire, I'm going to set up a foundation to teach media literacy. It's horrifying.
It's a crucial skill to develop, and I've been involved in some, giving some talks and like some textbook contributions. Ultimately, I don't believe that a media literacy class exists that can make people, like, you can get half the way there. Like, it's what we do here is try to figure out if it's real or not. But ultimately, you're doing journalism. I don't scoff at people can't tell if something's real or false, because sometimes it takes us all day to find out if one fact in a news story actually happened or not.
Well, that's the thing. We are swimming in too much information, and people don't feel like they're overwhelmed. They don't have the time. And there's massive disinformation out there. I think actually disinformation is probably the biggest problem we face in the world today, full stop.
Duly noted. I want to duly note a social media post by our friend and sometimes colleague, Kevin Sexton, who noticed something. A branded podcast company is asking for a government bailout for the industry in Canada. Others doing branded stuff have signed on. The era of the podcast as marketing tool may be reaching an end. And this links to a post from Jar Podcast Solutions. It's a Canadian company that makes podcasts for brands including Amazon, a little brand called Amazon, RBC, American Express, Deloitte, Expedia, and Cirque du Soleil as a branded podcast. If people don't know branded podcasts, you know, it's like some series about like innovative ideas from Intel. And this has been how a lot of people in Canada, we're one of the only companies that actually sells podcast ads and has paying subscribers. There are other podcast companies out there. And the ones that have done really well are the ones that just do these like very expensive, essentially sponsored content. I don't mean to put it down. Some of these shows, like they actually give them like free reign to do interesting work, but they're ads. They're long ads. And here is Char Audio making the case that the podcast industry, such as it is, drying up in Canada and the government needs to come to its rescue.
Oh, for God's sake.
They're arguing treat podcasting like the cultural force it already is. The Canadian Media Fund doesn't support audio-only content. Most grants don't include promotion or marketing. Like, government grants should support the promotion and marketing of ads from major international and American conglomerates. This is wild to me. And it's so Canadian to me, too.
Like, it is, yeah. I could see a case for creating a government-sponsored nonprofit foundation that supports podcasts, like a public broadcaster for podcasts. Okay, something like, I can see that. But they want the government to support advertising? That's a little incoherent to me.
Lisa, to be fair, they don't specifically demand that branded podcasts get its own stream of funding. But the fact that it's a branded podcast company asking for podcasts to be included in these funding regimes suggests strongly to me that like they would like some of this money.
They're shaking a tin cup. I think the Canadian market is very small, but people need to be a bit more creative and proactive if they want to make money through commercial means.
To the extent that we have government media grants for TV or for anything else, yeah, let's put podcasts on the list. I'm with
you. Sure.
If that's going to happen, and people can disagree about whether, but if it does happen, I will advocate for my medium. Let podcasting, and I want all the great podcast talent in this country to have work. But like, what? Like, it's this crazy thing in Canadian media. Like, you don't have some God-given right to make branded podcasts. Just because that was a thing doesn't mean that there's some, we can't let this die. Like it's not an issue of Canadian sovereignty or Canadian heritage. It might not even be an issue of Canadian culture. Maybe your, like, Lululemon branded podcast is not actually integral to Canadian culture.
Lululemon is not doing well, Jesse. I don't know if you know that.
Well, that's why they need a branded podcast. And I encourage them to come to Canada Land because we really can get to the essence of the Lululemon brand and find inspiring personal stories of wellness. Yeah, sure. No, it's not Canadian culture. It does not need a bailout.
Dear come God. On. Okay, interesting, slightly cringe and duly noted.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read all the emails that you send in. Lisa, if people want to read your articles, where can they find them?
New Lines Magazine is where I park most of my writing these days. I'm an editor there, newlinesmag.com. I also post on Blue Sky. These days I avoid Twitter, and most of my posts are public on Facebook as well.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Jules Bougiel, who also did the fact check today, mixing and mastering by Caleb Thompson. Our director of audio is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher here at Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Are you curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, feminism, and activism? Tune in to Rabble Radio on CJSF 90.1 FM to hear the latest news and stories that matter to you. Rabble Radio is the flagship podcast of Rabble.ca.
With Canada Canada's health system under strain. Going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns, to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
You're listening to